Freud and all of the personality people took us down a road, it's hard to appreciate how deep in it we are. How deep in the doo-doo of personality. How real it all is. I mean, you all think you have needs that must be met. You all think you have personality identities that must be honored. And even as I say that, I can feel you get tight, defending your right to have those things. Is that true? Yeah. I can feel it in myself, too. You know, I have a right to be angry. Damn right I do. We'll wait. You know, there's no rush. When you finish that trip, we'll be here. Because awareness isn't in time. It's just here. You want to enjoy your neurosis? Enjoy. Enjoy. Have more. Have another helping. Really climb in. Really climb in. We have gotten so thick in it, and so you're either getting into it through abuse of this or that, or you spend the rest of your life getting out of it, which is all giving it that plane of reality so much juice. And you look at your relationships from the point of view of your separateness. How will you fulfill my needs? I'll be who you need me to be if you'll be who I need you to be. Now, that kind of symbiosis, if that's all fine if you don't get trapped in it. But if you get trapped in it, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare rooted in your sense of separateness. It's like feeding the illusion of the separateness, which is the root cause of the pain. So if the game is to be happy, the question is whether fulfilling your needs makes you happy. And whether fulfilling your needs makes you any happier than not fulfilling your needs. That's an interesting one. It does for the moment, there's no doubt about it. But if you notice that when you live on the realm of needs, the minute one is done, another one appears. You have a hierarchy of needs, like a motivational hierarchy. I need food. Now I need ice cream. Now I need television. Now I need a cold drink. Now I need some popcorn. Now I need to go to bed. Now, these are all going on all the time. We all have needs and desires. We all have all this stuff. But just like I'm not going around being a bald man, I am bald, relatively speaking. For those of you that don't have eyes to see. But my consciousness is not full of baldness. It's an also-ran. Sure. In my hierarchy of desires, if I have yogic powers that Patanjali talks about, I'll create a beautiful head of hair for myself. That's a whim. I did it on the astral plane, so those of you that can see know. And if you see the way in which people get encrusted in their personalities, you can look at somebody and the way they stand, the way they dress, the muscles of their face, the redundancy is staggering of a person saying, this is who I am. This is who, they're basically saying, this is who I think I am. This is who I think I am. This is who I think I am. So you see helpless people going down, this is who I think I am. This is who I think I am. This is who I am. And you see bankers, this is who I think I am, this is who I think I am. You see car salesmen, this is who I think I am, this is who I think I am. Laid back hippies, hey man, this is who I think I am. Hey, baby, this is who I am. And everybody gives you a little matrix. They're walking down the street with these huge mind nets. And the net goes out and it catches you. And you immediately go into the, I'll make believe you are who you think you are if you'll make believe I am who I think I am. So you don't even look to see who it is. You don't see God is your only friend. You don't see that could be God in drag. Yeah. You see who they think they are, and you respond to it. And so everybody is going into the personality realm, making it real, and then interacting. And then looking at each other. And when you think your personality is real, that's all you see when you look at other people. You don't see that other planes of consciousness. I like the image of the man in a rowboat rowing through the fog. And he hit another boat, and he screams at the other boatman, "Why don't you look where you're going?" And the fog clears for a moment, and there's nobody in the other boat. He's just floating. And you're left with, because at that moment, the plane of consciousness shifted. There was nobody there. Well, imagine there isn't anybody anywhere. There's only one of us. There's just awareness. There's nobody. Who do you talk to? Can you and I enter into a dialogue knowing neither of us are real? Can we have needs without really thinking of them as who we are, where we're living? It seems to me that we come together through roles, through personality structures, through all these things. These are the vehicles through which we meet. These are the vehicles. The identification with the vehicle becomes a tremendous trap. And part of the yoga of relationship is to meet through the vehicle of all that stuff, but recognize that through the process of relationship, my relationship with you, let's find our way out of being trapped by that together. You help me and I'll help you. So that we can be in the role in a kind of celebratory, free, playful way. And take everything you're doing in your life, and instead of characterizing it now as need and pain and problem to be solved, like I used to be with Tim Leary, and the world would be falling apart, believe me. All the cars out in the parking lot would all be broken. These were new cars we had bought. The furnace would have exploded. We were in debt, everything. I'd say, "Timothy, we have a problem." He'd say, "How many times do I have to tell you, Richard, we don't have a problem, we need a plan." It was just like a little slip of consciousness. You know, I've had a series of friends who have helped me escape from my own mind again and again. It's a great blessing to have them through humor, through demand. I remember driving across the country with a friend once, and we were driving along, and I was busy being neurotic and getting somewhere, and we'd pass a store at the Grand Union supermarket, and he'd say, "Grand Union." I'm looking on the map to find out where we're going to have lunch, you know, and he's busy with Grand Union. But it would sink into my consciousness as if from a distance. It would slowly filter its way in and say, "Oh, shit, man," you know. Merge. I need to do them all dead end. Just constantly slipping consciousness. I'm just playing with all of this stuff, so you have to think about relationship as yoga. In my history of being a therapist and having clients was that during that time, my psychodynamics were such that I was so not resting in my being, but in a feeling of inadequacy, psychodynamic inadequacy that was fulfilled through proving myself to the world and in other people's eyes, something that I'm sure somebody here understands. That when I finally got to be a therapist, I really needed to be a therapist. And I needed my patients to be patient. They were called patients in those days. I needed my patients to be patient. And I needed to be curing them. I didn't need to cure them because then they'd leave me. And then I'd have to go find another one. So I needed them to be being cured and be deeply appreciative of how I was curing them. But I needed them to stay a patient. I mean, I was going to sit at the side of a desk with a knee hole, and I had the clipboard. I mean, you just think of this pathology now in terms of where we've come in the years since then. This was 30 years ago. But I realize now, when I look at my dynamics, how punitive I was of somebody who came to me who was strong, who didn't really need me in that way, who wanted to be some free. I mean, I say kiddingly, but it's not so funny that if I in those days met who I am today, who came into his office, I would hospitalize him. Because who I am now would be such a threat to who I was then. So I invite you to examine the way in which your identity with your role and your personality dynamics are creating a very rigid system with other people, and whether or not you are using the relationships in a way to get free from that. First of all, do you realize you're entrapped in them? That is, you know, I wrote a chapter in How Can I Help called Helper's Prison with Paul Gorman. And the way in which you get into helping because it makes you feel righteous, it relieves suffering, it's all good things. So you get into, I'm a helper. And I realized as I examined the dynamics of my own helping and the helping of the people around me, how disempowering this was to everybody else around me. How it needed helpless people to help. And I was seeing how you could give something to somebody in one way where you're identified with the giver, which forces them to be the receiver. Or you could give somebody to someone and yet not be caught in giving and receiving, but just be in shared awareness. It's like when I give these beads from my right hand to my left hand, the right hand didn't get caught in giving, and the left hand didn't get caught in receiving. There was no giver, there was no receiver. And yet there was a giver and receiver. That's the key. There was no giver and receiver, and yet there was a giver and receiver. How do you play the roles? How do you have the needs without being trapped in them? And the first part of it is to realize you're in prison, to realize you are trapped. Not really, but you are thinking you're trapped. And what that appreciation does, and that's the appreciation of the nature of Dharma, what that appreciation does is it changes the way in which you look at your life experiences. It's the same thing about the issue of coming into your passion. As Alan Watts once said to me, Richard, you're too attached to emptiness. You know, it's pushing away the form too much. And the form becomes the curriculum. The form is the projection of the mind. Which forms you see, that's your karma writ large. And the issue of extricating oneself from those clingings, not to be not in them, but to be in them and not in them. Now you have the possibility of being with other people who are not trapped, who are always in that spacious awareness. Ramana Maharshi's beautiful example, just very, always so simple and present and loving. That blend of compassion and emptiness, that's the way those come together. I was in Madras, I believe, and I met a man who was in his 50s, I guess, and he had grown up as a small child around Ramana Maharshi. And he used to sit on his knee and all that. And then he grew up and he became an army officer, and now he's sort of retired or something like that. And he said, one day, he said, an English gentleman came to the ashram. And he said, this English gentleman was the head of a large set of businesses, and one of his set of businesses was in Madras. And the businessman was having trouble sleeping, and he was very agitated and very upset. And the manager of his Madras store said, a business said, you should meet this saint at Arunachala, Tiruvannamalai. And so the Englishman agreed, and he flew over to India in a flying boat, as the story was told, whatever that means, with a seaplane. And he came to Madras, and his manager took him to see Ramana Maharshi, and he was going to stay there for several weeks. And he came into the hall, and the hall was silent. Everybody was sitting there. And he sat down, and nothing happened. And now this is a very successful businessman. And he started to get more and more agitated. And it was about 15 minutes before he couldn't stand it any longer. And he stood up, and he was like, I'm leaving here. This is silly. I can't spend my time this way. And Ramana Maharshi, who very rarely talked, said to him, sir, before you leave, would you do me one favor? And I said, yes. Would you be kind enough to write a note to your wife? This is our request. All right, if that's what you want. They brought him paper and a pen, and he wrote, Dear Hilda, I didn't find what I wanted here. I'll be back on Tuesday. Did you water the plants? And has Doris gone to the dentist? Signed, Henry. And Ramana Maharshi held out the hand, and the note was there. Ramana Maharshi folded it, and he put it up under his buttock, which was naked. And he said, would you be kind enough just to stay with me for 5 minutes? And I said, all right. And they sat there for 5 minutes. Then Ramana Maharshi got up, and he started to shuffle out of the room. And as he passed the man, he handed him the paper back. And then he went out of the room, and the man said, like, what kind of crap is this? What am I doing? I've come here. This guy's mad and insane. And he looks down at the paper, and it's on a different piece of paper. And he opens it up, and it says, Dear Harry, I'm sorry you didn't find what you want in India. I have watered the plants. Doris has gone to the dentist. I would write a longer letter, but the tall man with the turban who brought you a note is insisting I answer very quickly. Signed, Hilda. Now, those are cheating. Those are miracle stories. They're really not anything at all, but it's just fun to hear a story like that. Just to realize the game is played on many levels. Many levels. Shirdi Sai Baba, not Satya Sai Baba, but Shirdi, the old Baba. He was a miracle Baba. He said, I give people what they want, so they'll want what I give. Because you realize that freedom has nothing really to do with miracles at all. Miracles are just reminding you that it's not the way you think it is. And that frees you a little bit to be able to wonder, how is it? When you wonder, how is it? You're hooked. So you enter into a relationship with another person if you're lucky. It could be a friend, it could be a partner, it could be a fellow employee, it could be somebody you meet once a month or once a week or to study with or something like that. Will you enter in with the contract? Let us help each other awaken. Let us help each other remember together. Let's use our relationship to remind ourselves that we're stuck. That we don't have to be stuck. That we are already free. We're just busy being stuck. And these are very, very precious relationships. And they are very rare. I wish there were more of them. I wish we all had them all the time. But they are rare. And a lot of people who say they'd like to enter into that don't really want to. They just want to be somebody who wants to want to enter into it. And that's most of us. Because you come to the point where you are so familiar holding on to who you think you are, your psychodynamics, that you take even the fancy contract to awaken and use it in the service of your psychodynamics. I'm helping you awaken, for God's sake. You're trapped. And I'm free, and I know I'm free because I see how trapped you are. Damn it. I love it. Oh, boy. I think when you're working with another person in being free together, so that each moment in a relationship is the moment for us to be just here, together, dancing through the form. It's like the form of lecturer and listener. Can you hear without getting caught in listening? Can I speak without getting caught in speaking? Can you and I be together through this dance of talking and listening? Does this talking and listening separate me from you because you're them? Or am I in the world of us sharing this breath together? And is it bringing the us closer together? I have all these little aid mechanisms, techniques to remind me. They're all traps. They're all traps. All methods are traps. And meditation is a trap. You don't want to end up a meditator. You want to end up free. Judaism is a trap. This is a hard one. For those that are Jews, you don't want to end up a Jew. You want to end up free. I was just in Israel, and I tried saying things like that. Sure, then you delight in all the forms. You delight in your sexual identity, in your religious identity, in your social and economic identities, and your political identities, and all of your family identities, but you're not trapped in them. And in relationships, there is a balance. You don't ignore the personality stuff because it's still real to people. You fulfill it in the way you can without getting lost in it. It is up to the most conscious person in a relationship to create the space where the relationship can grow. And I'd be with Maharaji, and I'd be very serious about something, and he'd just giggle. And what I'm left with over the years are things like the giggle. Maharaji was, for me, that mirroring process, and yet he was passionately alive. He was chiding and throwing things and screaming at people and laughing and holding and doing all that stuff. And at the same moment, it was just like a vast mountain of emptiness. We were all busy with our personality. Who can get his foot to massage it? Who can get closest? Who will he give a name to? Who will he love the most? There was a guy who I knew from the state. He was kind of unbalanced at that time because he had had a bad love affair. And so I told him to come to India, and he came to India. And every time he tried to get near Maharaji, Maharaji would push him away. And I got really upset with Maharaji because this guy really needed something. So I brought him into the room, and I sort of aimed Maharaji at him, you know. And Maharaji would ignore him completely, and I would get more and more furious with Maharaji. And then at one moment, Maharaji turned and attended to him, and within a week, that guy had moved into the top slot in the whole temple, and he was going into the room when I couldn't, and I was hating that guy, absolutely detesting him. It was absolutely extraordinary. It's interesting that this kind of stuff we do when we come together and we study and we work and we meditate and we sing and we do all this, and we do it over years, and you can feel how we are changing. We are slowly, 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 and there's no time again, so it could happen from person in a moment, but you can feel the process going on of lightening up, of not taking the personality so seriously, of not taking the dramas of life, not getting so trapped in them. Not pulling back, but not being trapped. Passionate involvement and emptiness. A joy that doesn't deny what is in the world and isn't trapped by it. And it's all process. It doesn't end. It's just a continuous process. Continuous process. Maharaji kept a diary. And every day in the diary, I mean, can you imagine a realized being keeping a diary? What do you suppose he thought was significant that he wrote down every day? 2 pages he wrote every day. And he had books of it, book after book, and it was all stacks of these books. Every day, 2 pages. He wrote all the critical events that happened during the day. You open the page, it says, Ram, 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 Ram. Just 2 pages of Ram, 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 Ram every day. And when he was about to die, he gave it to Sudhima, this incredible woman. He said, would you keep my diary from here on in? It's called his diary. And he would just bring it all back into its source all the time. And he was still doing practices. But it wasn't practices out of need. It was practices out of celebration. He's just celebrating it all. And then just this one other little story. I knew, I could tell in my inner gut who he was. And I knew who I was. Hear the tone? I knew who I was, and I knew who he was. And I wanted what he had. So I'd have it too. And the problem was he kept distracting me all the time. You know, he'd come and he'd talk to me about America. Who gave a damn about America? I wanted to get enlightened, you know. And I saw that more talking about America didn't get me anywhere. So one day I determined not to be sucked in. And I was brought out to the temple with this Indian man. And it was just the Indian man and me and Maharaji. It was late in the, it was sunset. So the Indian man and I came up to Maharaji's tucket and we sat down in front of him. And I decided I had been reading Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga. So I brought my awareness to my third eye, my ajna. And I sat there. I went into meditation. Like, damn it, you give me what I want. And he said, Ramdas. And he started to ask questions, and I ignored him. I wasn't going to have any bullshit. He wasn't going to con me this time. I wanted it now. At which point, he leaned over on his elbow, and he started to snore. Okay. And when he snored, my body absolutely exploded. I mean, it was Kundalini City in there. My head started to shake, and my whole body was shaking, and I thought, I really experienced that I was about to break my neck. It was so violent. And I was getting frightened, and at that point he sat up, and the whole thing stopped, and he said to the guy, ask Ramdas how much money Stephen makes. I mean, what he's basically saying is, you'll put on the crudity, you stop fucking around. When you're ready, you'll get it. You know, stop being greedy, be patient, don't rush, you know, get over that trip. Relax. Okay. Because ultimately, it's so ordinary that all the little increments in energy you don't even notice. Not like I've got all this power. So I encourage you to look at your relationships as vehicles for awakening. Now, there are two kinds. One is where you've got somebody in it that wants to awaken with you, and the other is where they don't. And those are just two different kinds of yoga for you. One is with satsang and one is without it. But the interesting thing about the one without it is that's in your own head. They're satsang, they just don't know it yet. And you're not demanding they be satsang. You're just looking through the veil of their mind's denial of who they are to be with who they are. But you can only do that when you're resting in it, because it takes one to see one. You're constantly working on yourself, just coming back into that balance, into that equilibrium, and then looking and seeing everybody else here in the same space with us. We're all here together. We're all in this awareness. And then you see people dipping down, getting caught into their needs, desires, fears, personality, and losing the balance. And you're just sitting here saying, oh, losing the balance. What? Oh. A relationship as a vehicle, patience, see, realizing there's nobody in the other rowboat. Nobody in the other rowboat. And the excitement of being with another human being, and you've been lost in your drama for thousands of incarnations together. and then you've got to come up for air together. What an incredible joy to be with another human being and be free. And the far out thing is it takes exactly one moment. I would watch. I'd stand behind Maharaji, and they'd, like the army had Hanuman as their Ishtadev, their divine form. So Hanuman is on all the army flags in India. And the army trucks would be coming from the China border, and they would come by the little temple up in the Himalayas, and the trucks would all stop, and everybody would come into the temple because it was a Hanuman temple. The pranam, and Maharaji was there, so they'd all line up to the pranam, and then they'd be given food, and then they'd go back. They were always fed at the temple. And Maharaji would be sitting there, and these army guys would be coming along, touching his feet, rushing off, touching his feet, rushing off. And he'd be talking to people, and he'd just have a foot out there, and they'd be touching his foot, rushing away, touching his foot, rushing away. Every now and then, he'd turn to somebody, and he'd say, "Your mother needs to hear from you." And he'd go back to talking. I was standing behind him, and I watched the guy up. And then I'd watch. Most of the people came by, and you saw the denseness of them being in honoring the guru. They were in a definite role game, deep in, honoring the guru, get food, go. I mean, they weren't doing it to get the food, by the way. I mean, this is a very pure situation. But every now and then, one would come and touch and look up, and you would see something happen at that moment. You just see something happen. And you knew that that whole person's life was going to be different from then on. And it only took that long. I realized that his business with me took that long. All the rest of it was collecting more out of my fear that something hadn't happened. Just far out. But you're more or less stubborn as to how quickly you will give up, you know? Damn it, my personality is real. I need love. I'm lonely. Good. Is this fun? How do you do? I'm Dick. She wasn't there for me when I really needed her. Oh, God. I was there for you many times before that. Boy, oh boy, you watch it, it's like, hey! Hey, everybody! Wow, dig this one. Look at this. This is really thick. Will they ever get out of it? No, I don't think so. It's all the stuff we're all in, right up to our eyeballs all the time. Does anybody want to get free? So relationships are a stinker of a yoga. Because just like institutions, they are an institution because it's so easy to go to sleep into them. I won't bug your ego if you don't bug mine. I guess one of the bits of wisdom I'm passing on is not to take yourself so seriously. To take it all lighter. To take it all a little bit more with hay. Hey. Wavy Gravy, our clown who's on the board of Seva, has always told us, if you don't have a sense of humor, it just isn't funny. And he has the serious glasses, the Groucho Marx glasses, on the puja table. And if anybody at the board meeting, when we're talking about death, destruction, violence, blindness, malnutrition of children, uses the word serious, they have to put on the serious glasses. So we won't take ourselves too seriously. Because taking something serious doesn't make it go away any faster. In fact, it keeps making it a little bit worse. And I just like this particular story. A shepherd was grazing his sheep when a passerby said, "That's a fine flock of sheep you have. Could I ask you something about them?" "Of course," said the shepherd. Said the man, "How much would you say your sheep walk each day?" "Which ones? The white ones or the black ones?" "The white ones." "Well, the white ones walk about 4 miles a day." "And the black ones?" "The black ones, too." "How much grass would you say they eat each day?" "Which ones? The white ones or the black ones?" "The white ones." "Well, the white ones eat about 4 pounds of grass each day." "And the black ones?" "The black ones, too." How much wool would you say they give each year? Well, which ones are you referring to, the white ones or the black ones? The white ones. Well, I'd say the white ones give some 6 pounds of wool each year at shearing time. And the black ones? The black ones, too. The passerby was intrigued. May I ask you why you have this strange habit of dividing your sheep into white and black each time you answer one of my questions? Well, said the shepherd, that's only natural. The white ones are mine, you see. Ah, and the black ones? They're mine, too. What isn't God? With Ram Dass, a talk recorded live at the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, in July of 1992.
Though I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. It's from Corinthians. And someday, after mastering the wind, the waves, the tides, and gravity, we shall harness for God the energies of love. And then, for the second time in the history of the world, humans will have discovered fire. That's Taya de Chardin. Love and death are the great gifts that are passed on to us, that most of us leave unopened. That is from Rilke, Maria Elena Rilke. This is a poem of Robert Bly's. A man and a woman sit near each other, and they do not long at this moment to be older or younger, nor born in any other nation, a time or place. They are content to be where they are, talking or not talking. Their breaths together feed someone we do not know. The man sees the way his fingers move. He sees her hands close around a book she hands to him. They obey a third body that they share in common. They have made a promise to love that body. Age may come. Parting may come, death will come, A man and a woman sit near each other. As they breathe, they feed someone we do not know. Somebody we know of, whom we have never seen. Just keep letting them run through you. Sort of like Chinese food. Don't hold on to them. Just let them come and go. They always touch you in the way they need to touch you. This is from the I Ching. The master said, life leads the thoughtful person on a path of many windings. Now the course is checked. Now it runs straight again. Here, winged thoughts may pour freely forth in words, but there the heavy burden of knowledge must be shut away in silence. But when two people are at one in their inmost hearts, they shatter even the strength of iron or of bronze. And when two people understand each other in their inmost hearts, their words are sweet and strong, like the fragrance of orchids. The path of love, the path of the heart, the path of emotion, relationship, dualism, taking you to the essence of love, taking you from loving to being love. It is the path of the heart. It, like all paths, is fraught with pitfalls and traps. And most of our emotions either are in the service of our minds or are frightening things that overwhelm us and make us afraid, so we protect ourselves from them. So we come through life a little bit like hungry ghosts. We are beings that have huge needs for love. But seemingly, it's like we have some kind of amoeba that doesn't allow us to digest our food. So though we get love, it goes through us and then we need love all over again. And it's so deep in all of us that we've built a whole reality around it. And we think that's the way it is. That everybody needs love, and that if you don't get it, you're deprived, and that the more of it, the better, and you need it every day from everything. In that sense, it's like an achievement. You see people that are achievers, the minute they achieve something, it becomes irrelevant, and their awareness turns to the next achievement, because they are addicted to the practice, not to the goal. The predicament with loving is the power of the addiction of the practice of loving somebody, of getting so caught in the relationship that you can't ever arrive at the essence of dwelling in love. If you imagine it in this sequence, that you are cut off in your heart from love, so you feel hungry. What that hunger is the hunger to come home. It's the hunger to be at peace, to be feeling at one in the universe, where lover and beloved merge. It's the place to feel fulfilled in the moment, fully in the moment. Closed off, you are like a bee looking for a flower. You're flying around, buzzing, looking. And just as with baby ducks, you can create a silhouette of a mother duck. And with a baby duck, if you run that silhouette by, that is the particular key stimulus that will awake the response of following and opening the mouth. And it's called imprinting, and so you can imprint the duck to a silhouette of a mother duck. So there are certain very deep patterns, whether they're psychologically learned or karmic or astral in terms of your astrology, whichever level you want, there are a set of factors in you that are like a lock waiting for a key to open it, but the key must fit into that lock. It must be a certain pattern or concatenation of factors. Like the fact that I could open to my guru, I am sure had something to do with my relationship to my father. You think, well, the spirit is the spirit and psychological is psychological, but all of your psychological conditioning prepares you to be attracted to certain methods or certain paths or to certain people. For many people, the energies they're working with at the time they are seeking this love so strongly are second chakra energies, energies of desire, of sexual desire, of desire for union that is relational, and the energy gets into that pattern. And you associate making love as a vehicle to coming into love. So you're going along as a little lock waiting for key, and along comes a shadow of lover. And like a little duckling, you turn and you start to walk after it. It just happened to be the particular pattern that turned you on, that opened you up, that did it. And you say, I think I'm in love with him or with her. See, that's the key right there. Not, I think I'm in love. I think I'm in love with her or with him. And if you're lucky, your key unlocks her or his lock, and his key unlocks your lock, or her key unlocks your lock. So you get into, you love me, I love you, here we are. And it's incredible. Because through this dynamic, you have opened to the place. It's like the triangle. It's like what Bly talks about, as the two people together are feeding something that they don't even know. They're feeding the unitive space behind the dualism, they're feeding the quality of love. And when they're together, they touch it. What we're really saying is, when you say, I am in love with you, said somewhat blandly, you are the key stimulus that is opening me to the place in myself where I am love, which I can't get to except through you. You hear that one? So you can imagine, if you've been going around like a hungry ghost, starving for love, and you suddenly meet somebody that opens you to this well, this reservoir, this ocean of love, this ocean of feeling at home, and it's all rye bread. You know, you're just so happy. that quality that happens when you open to that, and you did it through meditation, or you did it through falling in love, whatever your method was, through acid, whatever you did it through, don't you get addicted to your method. You know, if acid did it, you want to know who your connection is, don't you? I mean, I do. Did. Do. So if you met a master and the master shared with you a method and the method worked to tune you to the place in yourself of awareness of love, you end up loving that method and you love that master, and the minute you do it, you get really drunk on it and very addicted to it. And fanatics in every religion are really, call them adepts or addicts. Because all methods are traps. And yet the bizarre thing about methods is they don't work unless you get trapped. So you can only hope that a method ultimately, after it traps you, it self-destructs. And you are left free of method. But you got to go through the method. And the method is scary because it does trap you. And the path of love is where you open to that quality, but the method that opens you when you're hungry is usually another person, and then you get very attached or addicted to being in the presence of that other person, and then starts the fear that that person is going to die or leave you or won't be around, and then you get jealous and possessive, and on it goes, and you just keep creating a hell realm around the addiction to the vehicle for coming to love. For even as love crowns you, brings you into that space, so shall it crucify you. Even as love is for your growth, so is love for your pruning. Even as love ascends to your height and caresses your tenderest branches that quiver in the sun, so shall love descend to your roots and shake them in their clinging to the earth. And this one from Farid Uddin Attar. To enter the valley of love, one must plunge wholly into the fire. Yes, one must become fire itself, for otherwise one cannot live there. One that truly loves must resemble fire, her countenance aflame, burning and impetuous like fire. Now let me show you where the problem is. This is from Hazrat Inayat Khan. The lover that leans upon the beloved's response, his love is like the flame that needs oil to live. But the lover who stands on her own feet is like the lantern of the sun that burns without oil. It is because of the way in which one closed down in development that one ends up hungry. Because the mind has veiled the heart from its boundless merging with everything in the universe. And we are like in a prison room, and when we fall in love with somebody, it takes us out into the sunlight again. We come back into the place of ourselves where we feel at home, safe, and loving. But when you hear that statement, that you are my key to the place in myself where I am indeed love, you see that the spiritual practices of devotion are designed to move you from I love you to we are in love together. Now consider love as a huge hot tub. It's a very personal image for me. Let us get into the hot tub together. We are meeting in the space of love. When two people meet in the space of love and break the attachment of mind to seeing the other person as the vehicle to get you there, but realize that it's in you and you start through your spiritual practices to rest in it, suddenly the need and desperation start to dissolve. And all of the negative things that go with addiction start to disappear, the possessiveness, the jealousy, the anger, the fear that the other person is going to die. Because the quality of love as a state has no time, it has no space, it wasn't born and it doesn't die. In the work I do with people as they are dying, I am often dealing with people who have lost someone who has died. And they are grieving. What they are grieving for, put in these terms, is their connection to the place in themselves where they feel safe in the universe and at home and at love and at peace. And they have so identified it with the other person, with an external thing, that they are absolutely destitute and feel like they have lost the juice of life. It really is like a meditator who can't meditate. It's the same addiction. You get so busy you can't stop in the morning to sit. And you start to feel like you've lost your beloved. You've lost the place of your being. And what I encourage people to do is to stay just with what they are feeling, with their grief. And I always tell people, how long have you grieved? And they'll say, oh, a year. I'll say, oh, go grieve some more. See, the culture says, well, it's good you're over it now. Now you can start living life again. But grieving has to run its course. Those are very, very deep attachments. And you go up and you go down and you think, I've broken out, and then the next moment you crashed into depression, and on it goes, up and down and up and down. And as you and I get older, more and more of our friends and loved ones die, or people die now because of epidemic and so on, and we all have to deal with this loss. And we lose friends, and because of our mobility, people are moving away from each other. And we have, in some way, closed our hearts out of avoiding the pain of losing love, and then we go around armored.